North Korea is launching more missiles, but now it's President Biden's problem, still with no easy solutions.
To quote Mike Tyson, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth.
Also today in Myanmar, protesters are turning their rage on China, even targeting Chinese-owned factories. They want Beijing to stop supporting Myanmar's military, especially openly at the UN.
The reason why UN is not doing anything effectively is because of China. So that's why people are very angry.
And a climate change researcher sets out to cut her carbon footprint. She quits flying, and then good things happen.
Once I decided to stop flying within Europe, adventure and romance actually followed from that.
The many benefits of limiting your carbon output. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be with you. We begin the show today in Washington, where President Biden held his first press conference. Reporters wanted to know, what is his plan for the border? There's been a sharp rise in the number of migrants coming north to the U.S.-Mexico border since Biden took office. Today, the president said it's not because of his policies.
It happens every single solitary year. There is a significant increase in the number of people coming to the border in the winter months of January, February, March.
The president tried to walk a fine line this afternoon, presenting a tough stance on immigration, but also one that is not inhumane. One reporter asked whether Biden moved too quickly to roll back the Trump administration's policies on immigration.
I make no apologies for ending programs that did not exist before Trump became president, that have an incredibly negative impact on the law, international law, as well as on human dignity.
The president also talked about the numbers of children coming to the border. He said crowded conditions in shelters along the border are totally unacceptable and that his team has been working to find additional locations and safe housing. But Biden was clear he would not turn children away from the U.S.
The idea that I'm going to say, which I would never do, that if an unaccompanied child ends up at the border, we're just going to let him starve to death and stay on the other side. No previous administration did that either, except Trump. I'm not going to do it.
The president also said he can't guarantee he'll solve the nation's longstanding immigration problems, but he said he would make things better. One other thing the Biden administration will have to juggle at the border is COVID-19. When the pandemic first hit, the Trump administration used it as a justification to tighten the borders. The argument stopping most migrants would stop the spread of disease. The policy called Title 42 had plenty of critics, it still does, including global public health experts like Dr. Joseph Amon at the Dornsife School of Public Health at Drexel University in Philadelphia.
It's nice to think that we can control COVID at the borders, but the reality is we know that that didn't work in March last year and it hasn't worked for past diseases. And we need to have a more comprehensive and evidence-based approach to really be effective.
An evidence-based approach. So are you saying then, doctor, that Title 42, as it's being used today, is not based on science and not an effective way to help ensure the public's health, not for migrants nor for the communities they're hopefully coming to?
The basis for Title 42 was that people from outside of the U.S. coming in would be bringing in COVID. What we know is that COVID had already arrived, that it arrived via people flying from Europe. But closing the border with Mexico isn't based on objective science or evidence. It's not going to be the strategy that gets us to the end of the pandemic. Really, within the public health and medical community, there's no recognition that this approach was ever justified or is working now or needs to be continued.
That letter you signed in January sent to CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky and others, it states that imposing restrictions on asylum seekers and other migrants based on immigration status is discriminatory. Explain that.
I think the key issue here is that Title 42 only applies to land borders. So people can fly into the country and ask for asylum, and they're not subject to it in the same way. So it's specifically targeting a class of immigrants coming across the border and seeking asylum. You know, as a country, it's important to remember that we are based on our history of immigration. We are based on our principles and our ideals, and we should ensure that we continue to be a safe harbor for refugees seeking asylum and seeking safety from dangerous and life-threatening situations.
So what alternatives are there that the Biden administration could follow? How can the U.S. receive migrants and those people seeking asylum, but also prevent the spread of COVID-19?
There's a big challenge here. It's a humanitarian challenge, but it's one that we can meet. We can extend processing to be more quickly, to put people who are coming in and asking for asylum into households with relatives and family members who are already in the U.S. We can make sure that people have masks when they arrive and are using masks to prevent further transmission. There isn't a sort of special approach that we need to use for these populations. It's the same approach that we're asking every American to do and to implement right now.
I mean, it sounds like there's almost a need for a mindset change as well, if it's really all about, again, the science about masks and proper risk mitigation procedures.
What I think is really essential here is that the Centers for Disease Control under the Trump administration was politicized, and a number of the different policies and guidance documents that came out of the CDC were manipulated away from an objective scientific approach. And the CDC's reputation and its credibility was shredded. What needs to happen now is that the new director of the CDC, needs to make it crystal clear that from here on out, the CDC is going to uphold its mission and its pledge to the American people to put in place policies based on objective science. The imposition of Title 42 initially and when it was extended was an immigration control approach. It wasn't about public health. And if the CDC fails to close down this order, they're really going to continue to fail to do what most needs to be done to end the pandemic, which is instill a sense of trust, a sense of science, and a sense of solidarity as we move forward together.
That's Dr. Joseph Amen, Director of Global Health at the Dornsife School of Public Health at Drexel University in Philadelphia. How to Handle Immigration is also the center of news in the UK today. Britain is planning a major overhaul of its asylum system. Under a proposal, anyone who arrives in the UK without authorization could be deported, even if their claim for asylum is legitimate. The government wants to clamp down on false claims and human traffickers. Refugee agencies are calling the proposals heartless and unworkable. The World's Orla Barry has more from London.
8,500 people crossed the English Channel on inflatable boats from France last year.
Early morning in the Channel, a BBC crew spots a boat with 17 people on board, wearing life jackets, but that's not always the case. This crossing is dangerous and has cost lives.
Where are you from?
From Iraq, yeah. Who's that Iraqi from Iraq?
Iraq.
Many of the migrants pay people smugglers thousands of pounds to get from Calais in France to Dover in the UK. This week, Britain's Home Secretary, Priti Patel, says she wants to put a stop to all that.
An end-to-end reform that will basically now look at how we can create safe and legal routes to protect people who are fleeing persecution and stop them from being put in the hands of people smugglers and criminal facilitators, which we are seeing on a daily basis.
Under the new proposal, only asylum seekers who arrive in the UK legally will be eligible for permanent residency. Zoe Gardner, with the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants, a British charity, says the new plans are inhuman.
It's shaken us to see how cruel of a system that they're proposing and how unworkable of a system they're proposing.
Gardner says such measures will add further trauma to people who've already suffered enough. Hassan Akkad fled from Syria to Britain in 2015. His route included a perilous boat journey across the Mediterranean from Turkey to Greece, which he documented and later turned into a film. Akkad travelled through Europe by paying people smugglers and made it into the UK on a fake passport. That means he arrived illegally, but he was granted asylum and allowed to stay. Under the new rules, Akkad could face deportation. He told the BBC this week the new proposals wouldn't stop people like him making dangerous journeys.
And when people are in desperate situations, they tend to make extraordinary measures to get to safety.
Akkad says the changes will create a new two-tier system for asylum seekers. Marley Morris, Associate Director for Immigration at the Institute for Public Policy Research, agrees.
It seems wrong to say that some people who come and claim asylum through irregular means somehow aren't owed the same level of protection as someone who comes through resettlement. Because ultimately, if their asylum claim is granted, then that suggests that they are fleeing persecution.
The government says it plans to open up new safe routes to allow asylum seekers to travel to the UK legally. Following Brexit, Britain has no agreement with the EU on asylum seekers who travel from the continent to the UK. And Zoe Gardner says European countries have little incentive to sign agreements with Britain to take asylum seekers back.
The government's hands are completely tied and they're announcing this, you know, big plan for a new immigration system, but they haven't got any of the details. They haven't done their homework. They haven't got any deals signed with other countries in order to actually make it happen.
Which means many asylum seekers who arrive in the UK will be left in legal limbo. The British Home Secretary says the proposed changes are needed because the current system is clogged up with what she calls bogus claims and legal wrangles. But Marley Morris says that's just not true.
Well, I don't think that's an accurate representation of the current system. If you look at the data over the last couple of decades, there's actually been a fall in the number of asylum claims since the heights in the early 2000s.
In fact, the numbers of people claiming asylum in Britain are far lower than in many EU countries. Last year, 36,000 people applied for asylum in the UK. In France, the figure was over 90,000. The proposals are still in the draft stage, but with Boris Johnson's Conservative Party holding a majority in Parliament, they're expected to sail through the legislative process. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The Bank of England has issued the last in a series of four new banknotes. Winston Churchill became the new face on the £5 note, novelist Jane Austen on the 10, romantic painter J.M.W. Turner on the 20, and on the new 50, this man.
I'm designing a machine that will allow us to break every message, every day, instantly.
Alan Turing, portrayed there by Benedict Cumberbatch in The Imitation Game. Turing broke the Nazi Enigma Code and helped the Allies win World War II. Today, the chief cashier with the Bank of England, Sarah John, was on the BBC listing Turing's many accomplishments.
Father of computer science, coming up with the idea for what is now known as the modern computer, but also work in developmental biology. He used maths to explain how patterns in nature form.
Sarah John said that the choice of Turing was an effort by the Bank of England to, quote, represent the diversity of UK society.
And I'm so proud to be putting the first gay man on a banknote.
Mind you, she speaks for the same British government that tried Alan Turing for gross indecency back in 1952. The man who broke the Nazi code acknowledged his relationship with another man. The conviction stripped Turing of his government security clearance, and his sentence included chemical castration. 2 years later, at age 49, Alan Turing took his own life. Turing's ideas are still with us. In an official video from the Bank of England marking today's occasion, British physicist Simon Singh cites the Turing test, a benchmark for assessing artificial intelligence.
Instead of asking whether a computer could think, the question now was whether a computer could think like a human. And perhaps today that's the part of Turing's legacy that preoccupies us.
Then actor Stephen Fry brought it all home.
By choosing this man as the figurehead, we are attesting to our belief that people should be judged by what they contribute to the world and the ideas they bring, and not anything else.
Alan Turing's image, and also one of his groundbreaking mathematical formulas, now the face of Britain's £50 note. Tough choices in India with a pandemic. As the country faces a spike in cases, can it still afford to export the vaccines it produces? That story's just ahead. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In India, public health officials are facing a dilemma. They're dealing with a spike in COVID-19 cases and a new worrisome variant of the coronavirus. Meanwhile, the Serum Institute of India, the world's biggest vaccine maker, had committed to send hundreds of millions of doses of vaccine to COVAX. That's a global vaccine sharing initiative that many lower-income countries are relying on. But India has now put a temporary hold on all major vaccine exports. Here to talk with us about India's predicament is Srinath Reddy. He's president of the Public Health Foundation of India and joins us from just outside New Delhi. First of all, how worried are you about this new variant of the coronavirus that's been detected in India?
Well, this particular new variant itself is not a big source of worry as yet. This mutant, which has been labeled the double mutant because it carries two mutations which have been noticed elsewhere earlier, potentially resulting in greater infectivity, has so far accounted for only a small fraction of the cases. But there is apprehension that the mutants, especially the one from Britain and possibly the others too, could actually start contributing in larger numbers.
Yeah, presumably you'll be keeping your eyes on those numbers and those variants.
Yes. Now the genomic screening is being really ramped up substantially.
The spike in cases, though, I mean, it puts Indians in a real bind given commitments to send vaccines abroad. How do Indian officials go about weighing these competing priorities right now?
Well, just today, one of the senior officials of the government announced that there is no shortage of vaccines as of now for the domestic utilization. But now the eligibility criteria are being relaxed, and we are seeing that more people are likely to be vaccinated, partly because we are now removing the restriction for people above 45. Therefore, many more are likely to be immunized. And secondly, the vaccine hesitancy, or let us say apathy, has decreased because of the rising number of cases. People are now more willing to get vaccinated. Thirdly, there is evidence now available of AstraZeneca vaccine's efficacy, and also early evidence from interim results of the Indian vaccine's efficacy as well at 81%. So people's confidence in vaccines is being restored. For all of these reasons, the Indian demand is likely to go up, but we'll have to wait and see whether the supply will keep match and also permit export. The government feels that it will, but we'll have to wait and see whether it'll happen. But two or three other Indian manufactured vaccines, some developed in India and some which have been licensed for manufacture in India, are also likely to meet the regulatory approval within the next 1 to 2 months. So the vaccine supply chain may not be as constrained, but I think the government is reviewing the position now vis-a-vis the international export volumes and the Indian domestic demand, which is ramping up, and then they will strike a balance.
The spring calendar in India is, of course, usually packed with festivals. What could more COVID cases mean for celebrations this year?
Essentially, the government is now appealing that people should avoid crowded events and especially large-scale social celebrations like big weddings, not the big fat Indian wedding, or even other religious congregations. Though some of the political rallies are still continuing and some of the elections are still around the corner, so people are saying, why are you shutting some things and not shutting other activities? But I think as things move ahead, the government's appeals that people must avoid crowded events is going to get repeated more frequently with more rigorous enforcement.
Srinath Reddy is president of the Public Health Foundation of India, speaking with us from just outside New Delhi. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
North Korea is at it again. Pyongyang fired two ballistic missiles today into the Sea of Japan, the nation's first major provocation of the Biden White House. The missile test is a clear violation of UN sanctions. So how might this American president deal with the situation? We're joined now by Sung-Yoon Lee. He follows Korea closely from his perch at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. If you were the National Security Advisor today, Sung-Yoon Lee, and you got called into the White House, what would your message be for President Biden?
Well, my team would have fully expected this sort of re-emergence of North Korea's provocations. At the same time, even if we have a plan, to quote Mike Tyson, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. How would we implement the plan? All depends on the degree of North Korea's further provocations to come.
So you said this missile test was fully expected. Why?
Kim Jong-un basically told the world that he would restart his cycle of provocations, after which there comes a post-provocation peace ploy. So the real question is, does the Biden administration have the fortitude not to settle for talks for the sake of talks, during which the Kim regime buys more time and more money in the form of lax or non-sanctions enforcement to further build the bomb?
So North Korea is struggling with hunger right now. Would sanctions be the wisest thing to attack the North Korean leadership over and further injure their people?
Well, there is always negative trickle-down effect, but sanctions have become much more targeted on the regime instead of the people. I'm not denying that there is a deleterious effect of sectoral sanctions banning North Korea's exports of textiles, for example, but there are waivers for humanitarian aid delivery. So sanctions enforcement is the one non-lethal and internationally legitimate tool of painting Pyongyang into a corner in the U.S. toolbox.
China is North Korea's only major trading partner, and so it has more sway over Pyongyang than other capitals. But with relations between Washington and Beijing unraveling, have we lost the one power that can influence North Korea?
Well, China has very different national interests. We know that North Korea is dependent on China for aid, food, and fuel. So China does not fear a small aid-dependent North Korea with a small nuclear arsenal. China is surrounded by bigger powers with bigger nuclear arsenals. So China sees North Korea as a useful card to play vis-a-vis the United States. So it would take a lot to get China on board.
So if we zoom out and consider U.S. policy toward North Korea moving forward under Biden, what is the overall U.S. goal here? Is it denuclearization? And what does denuclearization mean to the North Korean leadership?
Well, the North Korean leadership tells us very clearly that by denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, we mean the removal of all U.S. military assets, not only from the peninsula, i.e. South Korea, but from the region, that is Japan.
Would you be surprised if that happens under Biden's watch?
I think over the course of the next 4 years, to expect that is a bit far-fetched. There will be an enormous temptation on the part of the Biden administration to return to negotiations. So if Kim Jong-un says, hey, why don't I send my sister to the White House? And then we plan for a summit meeting. Right now, Biden will not be interested, but after a period of chaos, it will be exceedingly difficult for the White House to say, no, thank you, go away.
Sung-Yoon Lee is with the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, speaking with us about North Korean ballistic missile tests in the Sea of Japan. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Coming up on the show, an Afghan rapper lays down some rhymes about life in his country. He's worried about his music if the Taliban comes back. Also today, for companies that say boycott Chinese cotton, China replies, no, we're boycotting you at the mall. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH and PRX. Myanmar is still dangerously chaotic following the February military coup, a civilian uprising defiant as ever, even with protesters being shot dead by Myanmar's army day after day. So far, around 280 people have been killed. But protesters in Myanmar are not just raging against the country's military rulers. As The World's Patrick Wynn reports, they're also angry at the superpower next door.
China!
Shame on you!
China!
Shame on you!
China, shame on you. Those are protesters in the city of Yangon chanting outside Myanmar's Chinese embassy. And this is the more polite crowd. Other protesters have waved banners saying, if one of us bleeds, a Chinese factory burns. And sure enough, that is footage of a Chinese-owned factory in flames, airing on a Chinese state TV channel, which added the menacing keyboard music. Beijing is upset, saying more than 30 Chinese-owned factories in Myanmar have been damaged by protesters. Speaking to Chinese state media, one factory owner said, "We tried to give money to this mob," he says, "and they refused it, saying, 'We just don't want any Chinese in our country.'" Then he says they torched his factory. Now, many in this uprising are mad at Beijing for backing Myanmar's military rulers with aid and with weapons. So I reached out to a protest organizer to find out more. He told me, first off, our main enemy isn't China, it's our own country's police and troops, terrorizing protesters with automatic rifles. Security forces call it crowd dispersal, but they're using live ammunition.
It's not dispersing the crowds anymore. No, it's just outright killing.
That's the protest organizer. In English, he goes by the name Harrison. For his safety, we won't give out his Burmese name. But he's in his 20s and describes the last few weeks like a horror movie, running from riot cops, hiding in strangers' homes. He and other protesters always write their blood type on their helmets or their arms in magic marker in case they get shot.
It's very frightening, but we don't want to get frightened the rest of our life. That's why we stay going out.
So back to China. China is a huge presence in Myanmar. Beyond just having factories, they're also building a giant port, a hydroelectric dam, and there are oil pipelines running from the ocean up through Myanmar's mountains all the way into China. So Beijing needs Myanmar to be stable and compliant. No matter what Myanmar's military does, Beijing defends it, Harrison says, especially at the United Nations.
The reason why UN is not doing anything effectively is because of China. So that's why people are very angry.
If there's any move at the UN to punish Myanmar's army, China vetoes it. So Harrison says Beijing is like enemy number two of the uprising. But what he does fear is that these anti-Chinese government vibes will become anti-Chinese vibes, because Harrison is himself ethnically Chinese. He worries because, well,
because some people still don't know how to differentiate between different Chinese.
Some might not differentiate between China's officials and people like him, one of more than a million ethnic Chinese born and raised in Myanmar, nothing to do with the Chinese government. He says people who are racist against ethnic Chinese in Myanmar kind of see them as outsiders, opportunists with lots of money.
Yeah, they think Chinese people are rich.
But Harrison says, look, this is our home, and we are risking our lives for it. The good news, he says, is that most of his brothers and sisters in this uprising, they get it, especially as they see ethnic Chinese also protesting and being killed on the streets. That is a distraught mother, Chu Chu Tin, speaking at the funeral of her teenage son, a protester. Yes, our family's ancestors came from China, she says, but we were born and raised here, drinking the same water as you. Don't you dare be divided against people like my son. Her son's name was Kan Yarhain, 17 years old, studying to be a doctor. 2 Sundays ago, he went to a rally in Yangon, but when police showed up, he was shot and killed. But Harrison says this will not deter other Myanmar Chinese like him.
The Chinese youths are starting to be more politically aware and making their voices heard more and more.
And he says they are ready to put their lives on the line for their country. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Chinese consumers are being hit with a steady message today: don't buy your clothes from H&M. The boycott idea is a response to a statement that the retailer made about a year ago. H&M expressed concerns over reports of forced labor in the production of cotton in China's Xinjiang province. That's the region where the Uyghurs, a largely Muslim group, have faced steady persecution. Danny Russell's been following all of this. He's a vice president for international security and diplomacy at the Asia Society Policy Institute. Danny, let's start with the timing of this. The statements made by H&M about forced labor in China are months old, but this backlash comes days after a coordinated sanctions campaign from the U.S., the EU, and others against Chinese officials. Do you see this as related, as maybe even retaliatory?
It may well be, Marco. I mean, we're definitely seeing a sharp uptick in the speed and the aggressiveness of Chinese retaliatory behavior. Beijing, as you said, responded not just forcefully, but almost instantaneously to the announcement of the US-UK-EU sanctions. And they counter-sanctioned specific individuals in the EU, which is kind of noteworthy because what the EU did wasn't that dramatic. But even more to the point, it seems inconsistent with their efforts to get the China-EU trade deal that they negotiated ratified. In this case, you know, I think the intent is to have other U.S. companies and international companies reach the right conclusion. If they can get H&M to back down, Nike to back down, just like, frankly, a year or more ago, they got the NBA to back down after the blow up over Houston Rockets general manager tweet about Hong Kong,
right,
then we are going to see more of this behavior in the future, not less of it.
Is this a new strategy from China when it comes to criticism over its treatment of Uyghurs in Xinjiang to hit back at international business, or is this a continuation?
There is a longstanding current of Chinese seeking to harness economic leverage and economic might to defend itself in political terms and to shape the behavior of foreign governments, foreign companies. There are some things I think that are new. There is a much more deliberate and much more visible effort now to link political speech with the benefits of doing business with China and operating in China. Really zeroing in on companies has accelerated under Xi Jinping.
You served in the Obama White House, Danny, as a National Security Council Senior Director for Asian Affairs. Do you think there's a role for the Biden administration to play here?
There is. It's not easy. I mean, first and foremost, this is a pretty good advertisement for why the world needs a functioning World Trade Organization, right? The WTO, forming a unified front and ensuring a consistent response across governments, across geographic lines, and frankly, across industries is a necessary precondition for really exercising some influence and engineering some pushback. But, you know, I think, Marco, that right now multinationals are walking an ever more dangerous tightrope as the U.S. legislates rules about what companies can and can't do with China, and China increasingly, you know, mobilizes state-backed boycotts to punish companies that follow the U.S. rules. Well, you know, they're damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Danny Russell, Vice President for International Security and Diplomacy at the Asia Society Policy Institute. It's great to have you here. Thank you.
My pleasure, Marco.
President Biden today said it's going to be hard to pull all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan by May 1st. But Biden added that he can't picture American troops still being there in 2022. Whatever the president decides, one thing has become clear. The Taliban, the extremist group that gave safe haven to the 9/11 attackers, is returning to power in some form. That is a huge concern for many Afghans, including people like a young rapper at the center of our next story. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
Growing up, Ali hated school. I skipped classes, he says. All I wanted to do was to get online and to listen to music. So one day, his parents offered him a deal. Get good grades in school and we'll buy you your very own computer. The following school year, Ali lived up to his side of the bargain. He was top in his class. And, as promised, he got a brand new computer. Kabul's frequent power outages and expensive internet were not going to stop him. Ali had now access to a whole new world.
Rap, musiqi, video editing, and many other things.
He says he taught himself the basics of rap music and video editing. He downloaded books, read blogs, listened to some of the biggest names in the rap game. For speed and rhyming, I looked to Eminem, he says. For the business side of things, Dr. Dre and Jay-Z. Today, Ali goes by his rap name, Ali A-T-H. The name doesn't really mean anything specific, he says. That's kind of the point. It's unusual, mysterious even. The rap scene in Afghanistan has grown a lot in the past two decades. The US-led invasion in 2001 brought down the Taliban. They had banned most music, claiming that it's un-Islamic. Now, Ali and many others like him make a living from their music and their celebrity status. All that could change if the Taliban comes back. My livelihood is on the line, Ali tells me, from his home in Kabul. I make money from my music and my YouTube videos. That's how I paid the bills. If the Taliban find out that I make music, he says, they could kill me. I don't even want to think about it. He's far from alone. Women's rights activists, judges, journalists, and politicians have all been targeted by the Taliban and ISIS in recent months. And as the peace talks continue outside Afghanistan, people like Ali wonder, will there be a future for them in their own country? Many have already left. Even Ali's own family. They moved to Iran after two of his cousins were killed in a suicide attack at an education center in Kabul. That was a tragedy for my family, he says. Ali has even more to fear. He belongs to an ethnic group called the Hazaras. The Taliban and ISIS have specifically targeted the group for their ethnicity and religion. But Ali remains in Afghanistan. He says he doesn't see himself living anywhere else. He wants to be close to his friends and community. Lately, he's been extra careful. I don't leave my neighborhood a lot, he says. I stick to areas I know. Even with this cloud of uncertainty, Ali continues to make music and record YouTube videos. His videos are mostly about his daily life, birthday parties with friends, shopping for a new coffee maker, making pancakes for breakfast. But Ali has big plans for the future. He says he wants to set up recording studios in cities across Afghanistan so that new musicians have a space to experiment. He wants to expand a website he's built that's dedicated to Afghan rap. And his biggest goal? To one day launch Afghanistan's version of Netflix. In the meantime, he says, with all the violence in Afghanistan these days,
wrong time, wrong place.
As the Americans say, I just hope I'm not at the wrong place at the wrong time. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
It's warming. It's us. We're sure. It's bad, but we can fix it. Three syllables shy of a haiku about climate change, it is, however, the mantra of our next guest, Kim Nicholas, today on The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Kim Nicholas is a climate scientist at Lund University in Sweden. She's got a new book out this week that aims to help people understand where they fit in solving the climate crisis. The book is called Under the Sky We Make. Kim, tell me more about the mantra that I just read. When do you say it? How often? And why do you say it?
So this is a phrase that I've been using for over a decade now in my teaching. It helps us orient because this is what science shows actually people need to know in order to both support more ambitious climate policy and make changes in our own lives.
In your book, you outline the five stages of climate acceptance. What are those and what inspired you to think about acceptance as a necessary step?
So I talk about the five stages of radical climate acceptance, which are ignorance, avoidance, doom, all the feels, and purpose. And that's based on both my experience and on research from psychology. What I've seen is that people can get really stuck in the first stages of either not knowing about the problem or knowing about it and being afraid to confront it or face it. I think the feelings there are really at the heart of that, and going from what we know about the facts to experiencing all these feelings, and including grief and rage and anger, and harness those feelings for action and actually stabilizing the climate.
We also know the effects of climate change do not impact everyone equally. We've reported that on the show quite a bit. And crucially, some of us are more guilty than others for causing the climate crisis, whether we know it or not. Who are the climate privileged, and how do you encourage people to confront their climate privilege, shall we say?
Well, I am one of the climate privileged, and that was something that has taken me some time to realize and kind of acknowledge, because about 10% of the global population are responsible for almost half of household climate pollution. It's those who have incomes over about $38,000 a year that are in the top 10% of income globally. And the more income you earn, the higher your climate pollution tends to be.
Is it about flying in planes or food or in particular driving habits?
So our research has shown that the three highest impact personal climate actions that someone can take to quickly cut their own climate pollution are to go flight, car, and meat free. Any reduction you can make in those three areas makes a really big and important difference for the climate.
Kim, I'm curious about your own journey to confronting your own contribution to the problem. Was it facing these statistics about personal carbon budgets, or was it another aha moment?
Well, maybe the biggest one for me was flying. I mean, I'm a recovering frequent flyer. So in 2010, I took 15 round-trip flights. And that definitely put me in this tiny group of the 1% of the population that does half of the flying and half of emissions from flying. But once I decided to stop flying within Europe, adventure and romance actually followed from that. So I met my husband in 2016, and we ended up basically having a wedding by train where he comes from Canada, I come from California, we have friends and family all over. But instead of asking them all to fly to us for one wedding, we went to them by train. Almost no one else had to travel, and we went by train between them. But yeah, it was really lovely.
So Kim, I'm intrigued. You started a Spotify playlist called If My Book Were Music. Is there a song on there that you feel captures the mood of Under the Sky We Make?
I tried to capture the feeling of each chapter in a song, and at least something about the feeling that it gave me. So I think a song that really speaks to me is Shake It Out by Florence and the Machine. To me, that song is about daring to be yourself in the face of challenge and to persevere, to not give up, and to help each other out through tough times. So I've found that really helpful, and I would love if my book played that role for some readers.
We are shaking it out with Kim Nicholas, a climate scientist at Lund University in Sweden. Her book, Under the Sky We Make, is out this week. Kim, thank you very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you so much, Marco.
The Vatican is causing quite a stir. In a recent statement, the Catholic Church said priests cannot bless same-sex unions because God, quote, cannot bless sin. Pope Francis signed off on this. It's an affirmation of long-held church teachings, but it's prompting some non-traditional reactions from across the globe. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Since his election, Pope Francis has made headlines for his seemingly modern views on LGBTQ issues.
The pontiff says that he endorses same-sex civil unions.
Reaching out to gay Catholics in a way no pope has ever done before.
Saying, quote, homosexual people have the right to be in a family.
Because of these stray comments over the past 8 years, some people were surprised that Pope Francis would support this anti-LGBTQ decree. But Jamie Manson, a queer Catholic, has been paying close attention to the Pope's stance. To her, this was not a revelation.
Pope Francis very regularly pitted the love of heterosexual couples over the love of same-sex couples. So I wasn't surprised. I honestly was quite relieved because it was time for some institutional honesty.
Manson is the president of Catholics for Choice, a progressive nonprofit based in D.C. While she welcomes the honesty, she says the Vatican statement could have dangerous global consequences, including for the LGBTQ community outside of the church.
This could lead very easily to hate speech, to policies that condemn homosexuality, to LGBTQ people being put in prison or even put to death. So that's what I try to say to people who think these doctrines don't matter to them or they can just, you know, ignore them, is you can't ignore the power of the church because it is a global force.
You can't ignore the church, but some people inside the church are saying they're not going to listen either. Unprecedented numbers of priests and bishops around the world have said they're going to continue blessing same-sex couples, no matter what the Vatican says.
We have to respect what Rome says, but respect doesn't mean to accept.
Gregor Maria Hoff is a theologian in Germany. There, he serves as a consultant to a group of German bishops who are formally reevaluating major aspects of the church, including its stance on sexuality. The process is known as the Synodal Way. Hoff and the bishops believe the Vatican statement last week was a direct response to their recent discussions on LGBTQ people in the church.
to state this now is an attempt to destroy the synodal way in Germany. Yeah?
Conservative Catholics have long criticized the synodal way, which started back in 2019. One of its pillars is including everyday Catholics in conversation with members of the clergy. Hoff said in these meetings, everyone is given the same platform.
It's the performance of participation. It's the performance of empowerment by discussing with each other. And a bishop has the same 2 minutes like a student which is 18 years old.
This format is a major pivot from Catholic tradition, where laity don't typically have much power. Vatican watchers say Rome wants to keep it that way, and agree that last week's statement was perhaps meant to put the German bishops in their place. Hoff says it didn't work.
We will not leave this synodal path. No, not at all. Not at all.
Catholic clergy in other parts of the world have also criticized the Pope's decree, including in Australia, the US, and Belgium. Father Helmut Schuller in Austria says this type of dissent is striking.
In former times, they tried to keep quiet, but now bishops were very clear in contraposition to this statement. I think that's a new quality to have dispute with the Roman bureaucracy.
Father Schuller is no stranger to disputes with the Vatican. He leads a group of self-described rebel priests in Austria called the Parish Priests Initiative. Its 400 members want to reform the church and update its teachings to fit into modern society. In part, that means continuing to support the LGBTQ community.
We had started to celebrate God's blessing with same-sex couples, and we think that's a very important pastoral service. It is very important to be with people with homosexual orientation, to give them signals that we want to change the position of our church.
Previous popes may have disciplined members of the hierarchy for refusing to comply, but not Pope Francis. Jamie Manson from Catholics for Choice says this lack of punishment could be the Pope's way of encouraging a dialogue that will impact the church's future.
Not in his lifetime, but I think he's creating the conditions for some sort of dissension, and that is new.
Manson, along with Hoff and Father Schuller, don't believe the increasing dissension among some Catholics will lead to a formal break with the church. But consulting theologian Gregor Maria Hoff says resistance in the church will continue to grow.
There's energy in this, and there's a need for change.
For the World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
If you want to dig deeper into the stories you hear on our show, or you just want to know what you missed while you were away from your radio, connect with us here at The World and get the global headlines sent directly to your email inbox. Sign up for our newsletter, Top of the World, by heading to theworld.org/newsletters. I don't know if you remember 1976 and the tall ships. The American Bicentennial was all people seemed to talk about that year. Today, another bicentennial, the 200th anniversary of Greek independence. Even in a pandemic, nothing was going to stop this party. The day began with a sunrise raising of the Greek flag, the president and prime minister in attendance. In the background, the Parthenon, symbol of Greece's ancient democracy. Later, during a parade in Athens, a military band played the patriotic march, Greece Never Dies. There was also a flyby of fighter jets from the Greek Air Force, with one of the pilots sending birthday greetings from the cockpit to Greeks at home and around the world. Even Prince Charles came for the celebrations and proclaimed the words that so many others did across Greece today.
Ελευθερία.
Χαίρε, ο χαίρε, ελευθερία.
Ζήτω η Ελλάς.
Ζήτω η Ελλάς.
Ζήτω η Ελλάς. Long live Greece. We leave you today with a popular Greek song from the 1960s, which captures some of today's patriotism. This one by Yorios Delaras is actually about the 1821 Greek Revolution. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Μου ξαναρχόνται ένα-ένα χρόνια δοξασμένα να ήταν το 21 να έρθει μια στιγμή.